This Ag Perspectives podcast features a conversation that we've had with Bill Bullard, the Chief Executive Officer of the RCAF USA organization. Mr. Bullard's been with RCAF for a lot of years, and we caught up with him at the first ever Oklahoma Independent Stock Growers Association meeting in Oklahoma City on Saturday, October 20th. I know that you've kind of been having something of a, I don't know if you want to call it a war of words or a war of some editorials, this type of thing. You recently have posted a couple of things, kind of taking exception to some of the things that a couple of writers have been saying in regards to the stance of RCAF and a relationship with the Humane Society of the U.S. What's going on here?
Well, we've taken some pretty aggressive steps to initiate fundamental reforms for our industry, and in particular, work on restoring country of origin labeling for beef and pork, as well as to reform the beef checkoff program. And knowing that there's not much we can do at the national level because it's been determined to be government speech, we're now focused on the state beef councils and giving producers a choice as to where their hard-earned money goes. And many that oppose our efforts have taken great exception to the work that we've done. And rather than focus on the merits of the issues that we've been working on, instead they want to marginalize us by claiming that we work with the HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States. And we certainly do not work with that organization, receive no funding from them, have no working relationship with them. But we have employed attorneys who have expertise in constitutional law, for example, that do have relationships with some of these other organizations. So they're claiming that we are in some manner working in an underhanded fashion because we have retained attorneys that have a prior history with these organizations that they don't like. The fact of the matter is we sought out attorneys who had expertise in the very particular issues we were working on, and we've been successful. And that's why they're fighting so hard to marginalize us, to affect our integrity, when the fact of the matter is we continue to fight for what our member policies have been for the past 20 years. These are our issues. We have developed a strategy. We have hired the attorneys, and they do what we ask them to do. And so there's no truth to the to their argument or their allegation that we work with these organizations. We do not. We are an independent group, and we are being very successful in initiating the reforms that our thousands of cattle-producing members have asked for.
Now, you do obviously have some relationships with groups like Organization for Competitive Markets, this type of thing, all right?
Well, this is an organization, the Organization for Competitive Markets, that was formed about 20 years ago, the same time we were. And we worked with that organization on issues like country of origin labeling, on trade reforms, on reforms to the competitiveness of our market, trying to break up the beef cartel, for example. And that group did, in fact, join with the HSUS. In fact, they use HSUS attorneys on some of their issues, and they invited us to join with them, and we said absolutely not. We would not work with the HSUS, and yet we recognize that they do, but we're running parallel courses. We're both working on the same issues. So from time to time, we'll join letters together, for example. We joined forces in Oklahoma to defeat the checkoff referendum that was proposed here a while back. But we have no ongoing working relationship with them. However, we work on the same issues, and from time to time, we will stand together on those issues.
Would you say, would it be fair to say that might be about as close as you've actually had a direct contact with HSUS is through working with OCM?
Well, because they do work with HSUS, we maintain an arm's length from that organization. We know who they're working with, and so we do not work with them working with HSUS. Our membership has said that our organization shall not work with animal rights activists that are working to reduce meat consumption, for example, so we simply do not do that. But again, this is an organization that works on the same issues that we do with respect to competition issues, country of origin labeling, and the beef checkoff program. But we are not working with them on their lawsuit with the beef checkoff. That's an independent lawsuit that they themselves are focused on. We have our own lawsuit, and they are not working with us on that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a couple of these things you've mentioned. Cool, mm-hmm. Kind of at the top of mind as far as a lot of producers are concerned. I know that there's a lot of discussion since mandatory cool was ended about mandatory cool versus voluntary cool. You know, what does RCAF really want regarding, do you want a mandatory cool?
Absolutely. And here's the fact. That was in 2002, Congress passed the cool law in response to the growing tide of imported food products coming into the United States. Congress recognized that U.S. producers could not compete with this substitute product in the marketplace unless they could distinguish their own product. Well, the fact is that the meat packers are bringing this imported product into this country, the same meat packers that are buying our cattle, and it's to their benefit not to distinguish the product, because if they can source it cheaper and sell it for the same price as a U.S. product, their margins are increased. So we recognize that the meat packers will not voluntarily label country of origin beef because it's against their financial interests. So we need a mandatory program, because a cow-calf producer that sells a calf has no control over what the meat packer does with the resulting meat product. So we favor mandatory cool and recognize that's the only way we will be able to aggressively compete in our own marketplace here in the United States. But country of origin labeling was not repealed for all the other commodities that we won back in 2002, fruits and vegetables, fish and seafood, nuts. For example, lamb, chicken, venison, goat meat, all of that, those commodities are under the mandatory cool law. So beef and pork are now the only outliers. We need to restore the country of origin labeling for beef and pork. And what's happening right now, after country of origin labeling was repealed, not only did repeal the section that said how we would label beef from imported meat with our born, raised, and slaughtered standard, but we repealed a provision that said that the imported beef product coming in from Honduras, Nicaragua, Uruguay, had to retain its foreign label through retail sale. That's no longer the requirement. When cool was repealed, that was abandoned, and now the USDA policy is to allow the imported meat product to go through a U.S. packing plant, have the foreign label removed, and then relabel a product as product of the USA. The packers like that one because, again, not only do they not need to distinguish the foreign product from U.S. product, but now they're benefiting from the U.S. cattle producer's trademark, the product of USA label. So we're working right now with our U.S. Trade Representative's Office trying to fix that portion of the cool law that had been repealed relative to beef and pork.
So if you were successful in that regard, what would that mean to a consumer then?
Well, it would mean that the consumer would know which of the products were indeed foreign products, because the product would retain the Australian, Uruguayan, Honduras, Nicaraguan, Costa Rica label, and so they could choose to avoid the products if they wanted to. And what it would really do, though, would cause a price differential at the retail sale, because we think the demand for that imported product is going to be somewhat less than the demand for USA product. So then you'll begin to see the foreign product price cheaper in the marketplace. That would reduce the packers' margins that they're receiving windfall profits from now, and it would give the U.S. producer an opportunity to demonstrate that there's a lot of imported products into this market. We need to restore full country of origin labeling for the rest of the meat. So it would be one phase in the process of restoring full mandatory country of origin labeling for beef and pork.
So you say a lot. What, you have any ideas on what sort of percentages or how many pounds we're talking about coming from Central America? Or you mentioned Australia, of course, too.
Sure. Well, we import approximately 3 billion pounds a year. So to put that in perspective, we produce about 24 billion pounds of beef every year from animals born, raised, and slaughtered in the United States. But if you then add to that the imported beef product plus the imported product derived from imported cattle, we import about 4.7 billion pounds of beef, either in the form of the beef product itself or what we call beef on the hoof, which would be the beef derived from imported cattle subsequently slaughtered here in America.
Right. And, of course, in the case of Australia, especially, that a lot of that is lean product or product that's then trimmings that are being mixed into our ground beef supply. That makes it a little bit tougher, I'm sure.
Well, and that's problematic for our industry, because 20% of the U.S. ranchers' income is derived from the sale of cull cows and bulls. And so here we are allowing an unlimited volume of meat, the equivalent of our U.S. cull cows and bulls. That's why cull cow prices are so depressed today. because rather than give our industry the opportunity to rebuild, to grow, for new entrants to enter the industry, we simply allow the meat packers to source cheaper products from anywhere around the world, bring it into the United States to suppress our domestic pricing here in America. And as a result, we're continuing to shrink. Every time the price point reaches the point where our industry wants to rebuild and to grow, we see an increase in the amount of imports that subdues those opportunities. And so we completely disagree with those who say, well, these imports don't compete against our product. They complement it, because we do mix this low-quality grinding product from New Zealand and Australia and Uruguay with our high-quality trim. Well, we did that, too, when BSE was discovered in Canada, and as a result, we were having to produce more of that product here. And as a result, we saw higher prices paid to U.S. cattle producers. So these imports from Australia are depressing the prices paid to U.S. cattle producers, both because it adds to the overall volume of available beef, but also because it competes directly with 20% of their income stream, and that's their cull cows and bulls.
Let's shift gears, talk a little bit about the checkoff issue. You alluded to the fact that you've got lawsuits right now, that your litigation that you've been dealing with. You kind of shifted gears a little bit this summer when it came to basically trying to expand the current injunction that lies against the Montana Beef Council. You've gone in with a new strategy of trying to go after, what, about 15 additional beef councils, state-level councils. Correct. Why?
Well, the answer to that is we used Montana as a test case. We believe that the Montana Beef Council was a private entity espousing private speech, and yet the federal government was forcing producers to fund that private speech. And that private speech money represent monies that would flow to the Federation of State Beef Councils, which is completely controlled by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. So they've been receiving about $10 million a year outside the normal flow of the checkoff money that goes through the Cattlemen's Beef Board and then is awarded as contracts. This is money that's siphoned off from that program, and it's coming directly from the state beef councils. So we want to give producers a choice. If they like what's happening on their state and the federal level, they can choose to have the state beef council continue to keep their 50 cents to fund their state programs. But if they're not satisfied, we allow producers to vote with their pocketbook. They can choose not to fund the state beef council and have all the money go through the normal supply chain through to the national program through the Cattlemen's Beef Board. And that's what this first case did. It empowers producers to choose where they want their money to go. It doesn't take a dime away from the beef promotion and research that we're doing. It just gives the producers an opportunity to send it to a private entity or to send it to the federally controlled national beef checkoff program. Once we won our preliminary injunction in Montana, and it was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, we then looked at other states that had the same structure as the Montana State Beef Council, and said all of these councils, these 15 that we have identified, like Montana, are private entities funding private speech. Some of that private money is going to an organization that is working against the interests of our members, and we want producers to be able to choose whether or not to continue funding them. And so that's the purpose of the initial lawsuit, and now why we have expanded. Our ultimate goal is to fundamentally reform the beef checkoff. We want producers to be able to promote and market USA-produced beef, not generic beef, so that we're forcing our producers to pay for our competitors' advertising. And so we have a long ways to go. So this is phase two in the process of initiating fundamental reforms to the nation's beef checkoff program.
Before we talk more about the additional beef councils, where do we stand on actually? In other words, you only have an injunction in place now. When do you anticipate maybe an actual court trial or court decision that would say yay or nay to this Montana case?
Right. So we have a preliminary injunction that lasts until the conclusion of the case. And before the conclusion of the case, we have asked the court to include these 14 new states. So that's the first hurdle that we have to overcome, is to get an approval by the court to include these 14 new states in the ongoing trial on the merits of the overall case, and then hopefully win a permanent injunction for this particular issue that we brought up. It's a constitutional issue. Can the government compel producers to fund private speech without their affirmative consent? The court said that cannot happen. That's unconstitutional. So we are, in fact, protecting the constitutional rights of cattle producers all across the United States, but focusing first on Montana, then on these 14 states. Then if we get that solidified with a permanent injunction, then we moved on to the next step. How can we leverage what we've accomplished here in order to achieve the fundamental reforms we're seeking at the national level?
You said, I think, an important word. You said affirmative consent. I take it that's the reason that it's kind of been flipped a little bit. In other words, a lot of times you've got the ability to opt out of a payment or opt out of the direction of the payment, which would be the case here. But instead, you're demanding that producers have to sign up to allow their checkoff to stay in Montana.
That's right. Our position was you cannot correct a constitutional violation of free speech by putting the burden on the producer to recover their money through an opt-out program. And the courts have agreed with us. They said to protect the constitutional rights of producers, if the money is going to flow to a private entity, the producer must first give their affirmative consent for that private entity to even sit on their money for a day. And that was our argument, and we won that argument. So now producers get to affirmatively decide whether or not they want any of their money to flow to the state beef council or if they want it all to go to the national level. No longer is the burden on them to opt out of a program that violated their constitutional rights.
So as we, you know, as again getting to a timeline, have you got a trial date kind of in sight at this point, or are you still somewhere, you know, down the road?
Well, the court is currently considering our motion to expand the scope of the case to include these 14 new states. The briefing is completed. We're now awaiting a ruling from the court. When that ruling occurs, then we will set down with a schedule on when the actual trial on the merits would occur. So we do not know at this point. It's entirely up to the court as to when they'll make their decision.
And that case will be heard where?
That case will be heard in the Montana U.S. Federal District Court system in Great Falls, Montana.
Okay. So at this point, you know, I know that the argument has been that you saw that these state councils that you've identified are compatible with Montana's structure. Why not just go after every single additional beef council?
Because our case is solely focused on the constitutional aspects of the beef checkoff program. And so we identified states that did not have government oversight, as does the federal program. So some states' beef councils are the creatures of their state legislatures, and it could be argued that the state legislature provides some managerial oversight over those programs. In other instances, the federal government does have more control over the day-to-day operations of the councils. So we wanted to keep this purely a constitutional issue, and it was only these 14 additional states that met that criteria, similar to Montana. The other states do not. They operate differently than these 14 states we've identified.
Bill, one more thing I want to chat with you about. I guess for lack of a better title or concept of it, or, you know, maybe direction on it, is this roundtable conversation that's going on right now. A lot of controversy about the organization, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, being involved through their membership with the U.S. Roundtable on Sustainable Beef. Your organization, I think, takes a lot of exception to that. Why your concerns?
Well, our concern is that our industry is overregulated. It's overregulated by the government. And as we've fought back against that, now we're seeing the big multinational corporations stepping in and trying to impose the same kind of regulations that will essentially dictate to producers what the terms of their production will be. It will require producers to engage in a national animal identification system using electronic ID ear tags, and that's an issue that we fought the federal government against. Now the corporations are coming forward with it. Then they want to impose on producers the cost of a third-party auditor in order to certify that the producer did, in fact, follow the production standards that these multinational corporations have established and that they have complied with the ear tag requirements. And then they would be granted timely access to the marketplace, because the persons, the entities involved in the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, control over 85% of the fed cattle marketplace. And as a result, what's happening here is we're seeing the corporations initiating control over the production of cattle for their benefit, and it's going to take profitable opportunities away from producers. So we're fighting against this Global Roundtable, viewing it as a means of capturing control over the live cattle supply chain away from independent cattle producers.
So we've talked already about your desire to see a mandatory country of origin labeling. You do not want a mandatory animal ID, though.
Absolutely not, and primarily because of the profit opportunities lost to independent producers. If there are packers who are selling beef that they want this additional valuable information as to the specific origins of the animal and how it was produced, we want the packers to have to pay a premium for those cattle. But once there's a mandatory program, the packers are gifted this additional valuable information that go along with each calf that is sold, and the producer receives nothing. So this is a marketing issue. We fully support our members who are currently involved in animal identification tracing systems, but they do that because they're receiving a premium in the marketplace. But once there's a government mandate, either through the corporations who control the marketplace or by the government, those premiums evaporate and producers lose.
So if this comes, it bubbles up through some of the major customers affect customers of cattle producers. In other words, the retailers, the restaurant chains, the Walmarts of the world, the McDonald's of the world, and they say they want their consumers, the people that are buying beef from them, say they want to know where their food comes from. We hear that a lot, and they're saying, as what we got to have traceability. If the market is dictating that, you're okay with that.
Well, certainly, and it's happening right now. We've had some packers, mid-sized packers, that are catering to the European Union's no hormone program, for example, and they go out and pay a premium to our members, who then voluntarily deploy the electronic ear tags, the record-keeping systems, and they're paid a premium in the marketplace, and that's how the marketplace is supposed to work. If the retailers want specific standards, they should communicate that to the producers, and in our free market system of cattle production, we will have entrepreneurs that will step forward and take full advantage of that. But again, that will all go away under a mandatory program.
Top hired hand for RCAF USA, Bill Bullard. On the Oklahoma Farm Report, I'm Ron Hayes.